I'm going to ask one question from the audience on a note card. What was Israel's justification for imprisoning half of the members of the PLC and thus preventing the democratically elected Palestinian parliament to meet? And why doesn't Obama ask for their freedom?
That's an excellent question. We all hear about Corporal Shalit, the terrible thing this Israeli soldier was held hostage by the Hamas movement. But as Israeli columnist, almost certain, even Naron Ben Denis, the mainstream, very smart Israeli political figure and also writer, he said, we have to be honest. We took hostage one-third of the Palestinian legislature. One-third of the Palestinian legislature were Hamas members, which Israel just arrested and said, we'll hold them until you free Corporal Shalit. That's just hostage taking. There's no difference between the two, except, of course, in the numbers.
Okay, we have the question right here.
Yeah, thank you. I have two questions. One, Professor Finkelstein, because you were talking about how there exists, an agreement, like a desire amongst the Palestinians to negotiate with the Israelis and find a, solution. I was just wondering about the other side of the border, about the, amongst the Israeli population, and it's, I'm not familiar with any kind of neo-Palestinian force, but I remember reading Machid Khalidi that after the Oslo Peace Accord, I think in the mid-19th, before Rabin was assassinated, there was quite a bit of great desire amongst the Israelis. And if you allow me to continue, I will, I've been standing here for a long time. I was just wondering, somebody like Lieberman, and I come from Pakistan, and I'm sure everybody is familiar that in Pakistan, extremism is really high. But to have, I can't think of a major Pakistani politician saying, oh, if you don't hold an oath of allegiance to the state, you will lose your citizenship, right? But somebody like Lieberman being such a major kingmaker. So I was just wondering about the health of the Israeli peace lobby, does it even exist, or etc., because that has to be like a foundation of the sentiment for peace. And just quickly,
Well, I'm glad you had a chance to speak, and I wish you had a chance to speak longer. I think we have to make a determined effort to free ourselves from illusions. There is a distance that separates, for example, the former Israeli Prime Minister and General Yitzhak Rabin from Avigdor Lieberman, but I think sometimes the distance is exaggerated. And here it's useful, I mentioned the book earlier, The Scars of War, Wounds of Peace, the book by Israel's former Foreign Minister, Shlomo Ben-Ami, who was a negotiator during the Rabin and then Barak period. And he says, number one, the only reason Israel entered into the Oslo Accord was because after the first Intifada, again, I have to be careful of age because most of you will not have even been born then, but in 1987, the Palestinians entered into a nonviolent civil revolt. It caused a considerable amount of problems for Israel. It didn't quite know how to police a population which was in revolt. And after the revolt was successfully repressed, Israeli leaders decided we really can't do this on our own, that we need some collaborators to do it for us. You say you're Pakistani, and you remember that most of the British dirty work in India was not done by British soldiers. I think my memory serves, there were only, either it's 10,000 or 100,000, my memory's off now, British soldiers in India. It was mostly done by domestic Indians who kept the occupation of India in order. And that's what the Israelis decided. We need to rationalize our occupation. and they were looking for a class of collaborators to do the dirty work for them. At that point, Mr. Arafat and the PLO were in very desperate straits, especially financially. It looked like they were going down the tubes. And so the Israelis basically, under Mr. Rabin, cut a deal with Mr. Arafat. We will save you from political oblivion, but the quid pro quo is you are going to have to police the occupied territories for us. Now, if you read Shlomo Ben-Ami, he's very forthright, and he says, Mr. Rabin never supported a Palestinian state. It's just a myth. And he said that Ehud Barak, the later prime minister at Camp David, he said, Mr. Rabin would never have gone as far as Barak did at Camp David. And Mr. Barak didn't go very far at Camp David because Shlomo Ben-Ami, who was the main Israeli negotiator, he said, and I'm quoting him, were I a Palestinian, I would never have supported Camp David. So what you have is the offer that Barak makes, Shlomo Ben-Ami says, I would never have accepted it. And Shlomo Ben-Ami says, that Barak went much further than Rabin would have ever gone. And so Mr. Rabin was not making any real peace offer to the Palestinians. What he was offering was, we'll let Palestinians police the occupation for us. I think that's the basic picture. And so on those basic issues, though there are others, but on those basic issues, the distance separating a Rabin or a Barak from an Avigdor Lieberman are not as great as is sometimes made out.
Okay, next question.
With regards to a boycott, divestment, or sanctions campaign, what could or perhaps what should such a campaign do with, and here I'm going to borrow a term from the Iraqi sanctions regime and also Israel's blockade of Gaza, so-called dual-purpose companies, specifically Caterpillar, which both produces important construction equipment and jobs here in America, and yet which are then used in Israel to demolish Israeli homes and also, Palestinian homes, and also kill both Palestinians and even American peace activists.
Well, I'll just be brief on that. I think that the precedent set by Hampshire College was excellent. If you read their call for a divestment, they said, let's stand with international law. Under international law, there is no question, no dispute, no doubt, no equivocation that the settlements are illegal. And therefore, if our university is investing in any company that has any relationship with the settlements, then our university should sever ties because it's been involved in an illegal enterprise, even if indirectly. It still is. Incidentally, under international law, the settlements are considered war crimes. They are in the Fourth Geneva Convention. They are part of the category of violations of international law, which are war crimes. Secondly, I think something practical that we can all do is that in every university, the Students for Justice in Palestine groups, they should establish a divestment committee and look exactly at the companies that Amnesty International lists. And it goes through the companies. It names Raytheon, it names this company and that company. And it says that there should be a complete arms embargo on all parties to the conflict. And they don't just say arbitrarily, they say under international law, You cannot supply weapons to regimes which are consistent violators of human rights. That's the law. And so we should exert pressure on our universities to be consistent with international law and consistent with the call of Amnesty International. And any corporation which is involved in armed supplies to Israel or the Palestinians, but they were talking really about firecrackers and Roman candles, we're not talking about armed supplies. Anyone involved, then our university has to sever ties because that's the law and that's what Amnesty says. And it was a perfectly reasonable and winnable demands. If we stick or hew closely to the international law, I can't see how any university administration can say straight to your face, no, we're going to be law breakers. And that's the position you should put them in. Are you or are you not going to uphold international law? It's as simple as that. Our slogan can be very simple. University of Illinois and Urbana-Champaign, enforce the law. That's what Amnesty says, and that's what we should be demanding. Just enforce the law.
I endorse all of that, so I just want to add very briefly a couple of resources people should look at, because everywhere I go, I get a lot of questions about BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and people have already thought through a lot of the issues and a lot of the questions. So go to the website bdsmovement.net. It's the official website of the Palestinian National Committee for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. It's put together by very smart people, and it lays out a lot of the kind of questions and answers that you may have, and you can also see what others have been doing around the world. There are a lot of press releases and notices about other actions people have taken. BDSmovement.net. Another one is PACBI.org, PACBI.org, which is the website of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, where again you will find the issues laid out clearly and examples of what's been happening around the world. And then the site which I co-edit, the Electronic Intifada, where we report on a lot of the developments and activism that are going on. So one of the first things you can do, I mean, make it easier for yourselves. First, see what other people are doing. One thing when we were talking at dinner that I suggested, or that came up in discussion, and actually I think it's already happening, is, get together with other campuses, other SJPs in your area. Don't try to be too ambitious and, go national all at once. But, you've got Purdue, you've got the universities in Chicago, all within a, 2-hour, roughly, driving range. Get together one weekend to discuss this. Invite the people from Hampshire to come. Ask them to come and tell you, what they did, what were their successes, what were their mistakes. And make sure, these are winnable struggles, but they won't necessarily be won. College students like the politicians run on 4-year terms. So you may not be able to achieve this all in your first term. Make sure you're involving the incoming and younger students so that they can continue the fight and continue the struggle when the more senior students have moved on. So I hope those are some practical suggestions.
We only have a few questions left, and they've been standing a long time, so I feel bad to cut them off. So if we could just get really quick responses for these questions,
then
we'll...
Should we take them all and then give a final response?
Yeah, that would be fine. We'll start right here.
During the siege in Gaza, in 2 years, refugee camp, Israel didn't allow Red Cross Central bound houses to look for survivors. So when they were finally allowed entrance, days later they found poor, emaciated children surrounded by 13 corpses, some of which were their mothers. This is a clear war crime and humanitarian violation. This is one of the use of white phosphorus, which is only to be used as on battleground as smoke, not towards civilians, and it was used towards civilians. The IDF is supposed to investigate these matters, but how can the perpetrator be the investigator as well? How can truth and justice be served?
I noticed that you guys didn't agree much on the conflict, but I noticed some divergence to the solutions, either a two-state solution or a mixed solution. And so my question is related to that divergence. As we look forward for peace in Palestine, could you guys comment on the state of affairs between Arabs and Jews prior to the to 1948?
Thank you.
Professor Finkelstein, as you said earlier, all the United States has to do with threatening Israel, and Israel will stop its state terrorism. So my question is, which is very relevant for all of us here, is what can us as citizens of this country do to push our leadership in that direction?
I'd like to apologize for the fact that I'd like to ask permission to ask my question separately after these get answered. I'm sure that the people that have stayed this long will have the patience for that.
I'm sorry, we have a room reservation until, we're already going to be going over a little bit, so we have time to add this question.
I only ask that because I came here looking at signs of an Israeli-Palestinian discussion.
If you want to ask a question, then just make it a question right now, please. Thank you. So those are your questions. If you guys have a final statement to make.
He's not asking.
If you want to ask your question and ask it, but we can't do it separately. Okay.
Those were actually three serious questions, not because I want to diminish its significance at all, but I think both of us, both Ali and I, tried in the course of the evening to suggest things that can be done to try to hold those accountable for the crimes that were committed, and what's equally, if not more important, to try to the best of our ability that these crimes don't occur again in the future, or at least minimize the amount of suffering in the future. The two questions I want to look at briefly are the divergence between Ali's opinion and my own, and what can we do? On the question of the divergence, since there are a number of Indians and Pakistanis in the audience, I'll just give you, explain how I differ from Ali by looking at the example of India and Pakistan. Over the past several months, I've been reading a lot about and by, less about than by Gandhi, who I have a great respect for. And as some of you may know, Gandhi devoted most of his adult life domestically to two causes. Number one, the equality of the untouchables, which he called a blot on the Hindu religion, what he called not untouchables, but Harijans, the children of God. That was one of his main causes. And the second of his main causes was Muslim-Hindu unity in India, of which he was a very committed proponent. It's often forgotten he was assassinated by Hindus because of his steadfast commitment to Hindu-Muslim unity. And the head of the Muslim League at the time was a fellow named Jinnah. And the main ideological difference between Jinnah and Gandhi was very simple. It was like Israel-Palestine. Jinnah was adamant that the Muslims were a separate nation. And Gandhi said no. He said, Muslims and Indians may, Hindus may differ by religion, but he was emphatic. They belong to the same nation. I will not accept it, that we're different. And of course, Gandhi had a personal stake. He enters politics in South Africa when it's Muslim Indians who ask him to serve as their lawyer. So from his get-go in politics, he already has a connection with Muslim Indians. And he was very adamant, but at the end of his life, Gandhi says, I have to accept the political reality that Muslims are, by and large, en masse, flocking to the Muslim League. I can't change that. And we have to accept it as a political fact. He says, even to the end, I won't accept that Muslims are a separate nation. But he says, I will accept that we are brothers, and sometimes brothers have to go their separate ways. He's not happy about it, and the populations were as intermixed as that map that Ali displays showed, but he said, there's no way I can change the political reality that the Muslims want their own separate entity to live in. I think that's basically, in my opinion, the same problem in Israel and Palestine. I have no doubt that Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs can live together. That, to me, is a no-brainer. I spend enough time over there, I meet enough Palestinians here. As Rodney King famously asked, can we all get along? And I said, yes, we can. I have no problem with that. But we can't abolish political realities which we might not like, but nonetheless exist. And it doesn't mean we have to give up our ideological beliefs. Gandhi says, I will never accept that we are separate nations. But it doesn't mean that politically it's possible now. And as I said, I think the same principle applies with Israel, Palestine, with the obvious repercussions which you can all figure out without me explaining it. And the second question was what we can do. And I want to just end on a very positive note, upbeat note, not because I feel an obligation to be upbeat, but because I think there's every reason to be hopeful. The Gaza massacre, regrettably, it took the deaths of many people, innocent people, to open the eyes of many other people that something seriously awry is going on here. Something seriously wrong is going on here. And now we have an opportunity. And I don't like to use loose expressions like play our cards right, because it's not a card game. It's life and death. And so we just have to be wise and prudent in what we do. And I sincerely believe if we are reasonable, if we do not try to out cure our neighbor, just be reasonable. Say to those who disagree with us, we're not asking for the stars, the moon, and the sky. You are not, by and large, the enemy. I always liked at the end of his life, Edward Said, you quote the Caribbean poet, M.A. Césaire. He liked to quote one line. There's room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory. And you should remember that. There is room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory. Whether you're Jewish, Muslim, Arab, Israeli, Palestinian, or Israeli, there's room for everyone. I pay close attention to the fellow who asked the question. Some of you are ready to dismiss him, but I notice he stayed. He listened. Doesn't necessarily have to agree, but many people's ears are open now. They're ready to listen. You don't have to agree 100%. Just be reasonable. Say all we want is the minimum that Palestinians are entitled to under international law. Be fair, be reasonable, and I'm very confident that we can win. But it's a win without vanquishing. We don't want to vanquish. And believe me, during the Gaza War massacre, I saw those pictures over the internet of those incinerated Palestinian children, that burnt flesh, those dazed look in the kids' eyes as they were buried in the soil. I really wanted to kill. And some of you who saw my website and some of the headlines I used, even now I kind of cringe when I look at what I wrote. I was very angry. It's very easy to lose your cool and you want to strangle and throttle the murderers, the marauders, the vandals, and the killers. We have to do our best to control the anger, control the desire for vengeance, and to just keep saying, we're reasonable. We just want to end the conflict on a reasonable principle of justice, applying basic principles of truth. And if you're willing to go there with us, then there's room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory.
Everywhere where these kinds of situations have arisen between different groups of people, there is a temptation to believe that simply separating people will solve the problem. And that never works. And a good example of that is India and Pakistan, where partition was imposed. Some people supported it, some people opposed it before it happened. What's interesting is that nobody, not the supporters, not the opponents, predicted what the consequences would be. Nobody predicted the forced movement of 12 million people. Nobody predicted the deaths of a million people. Nobody predicted repeated wars between India and Pakistan. Nobody predicted a nuclear standoff. Nobody predicted Pakistan being on the verge of becoming a failed state. Nobody saw that coming. What was the consequence? What is the population of Pakistan today? Does somebody know? About 160 million. Now, what is the Muslim population of India? It's more than that. It's close to 200 million. So today, there are more Muslims living in India than there are in Pakistan, and in fact, in Bangladesh as well. In the so-called Muslim states created, there are still more Muslims living in India. So what did it solve, except to create decades of bitterness and hostility? And you know what? It turns out that Muslims can be Indian after all. I think that everywhere you look, partition has failed. In Ireland it failed, in Palestine it failed. On paper it looks very neat, you separate people. But as I said in my comments, if a Palestinian state were created tomorrow in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, it doesn't solve the problem of 1.5 million Palestinians who are second-class citizens in Israel and still demanding their rights. I'm fine with a two-state solution, but there would have to be a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and a democratic non-Zionist state in what is now Israel. That would be fine with me. But what is impermissible is a racist state of any kind. And the only reason that Israel pays lip service to the two-state solution is because they think that that is their ticket to preserving Israel as a racist state, a so-called Jewish and democratic state. And that will not work. The key is justice, equality, stringent equality between Israeli Jews and Palestinians. And when you apply that principle, you find that the necessity of separate states disappears. The only reason to maintain separate states is to preserve inequality. So that Israel can say, those destitute Palestinians in Gaza, they're not our problem. They live somewhere else. Don't ask us for redress of their injustices. Now, nor am I so naive as to believe that you can abolish history, abolish people's national identities, or their cultures, and nor is that what I'm proposing. What I'm proposing is recognizing that you have people with different identities, different aspirations, and instead of trying to shape the state, shape the people to fit the state, move them around, keep refugees out, prevent people returning home, create artificial majorities here and there, instead of trying to shape the people to fit the state, let's shape the state to serve the people. Because all a state is a set of rules for people to live together. And it's perfectly possible, like in Northern Ireland, where it's being sorely tested, and it's incredible with the recent violence. I've been watching the situation closely, and everyone is afraid it's going to break apart. It may, but what was remarkable is to see all the former combatants from some of the most extremely opposed armed groups, people from the IRA, former IRA people, and people from former loyalist militias, standing together on the same podium in Belfast and saying, we will not go back. That was unimaginable a few years ago. And it's just as possible that they will prevail as those who want to undo it will prevail. In fact, it's even more possible. And when you look at the power-sharing government in Belfast today, between Sinn Féin and the Democratic Unionist Party, it was 10 years ago as improbable, as unlikely, as fantastic, as utopian, as a coalition today led by Hamas and led by the Likud. And you may think that sounds crazy and insane, but that's how crazy and insane it would have been if you'd gone back to 1998 and said, what are the chances that in 2008 or 2009, there will be a Sinn Féin and a DUP First Minister, Deputy First Minister? People have said, you are crazy, absolutely crazy. So anything is possible, but the principles have to be clear. Whether you're having one state or two states or ten, that there should be no refuge for special privilege or ethnic privilege. There can be protection. There can be mechanisms to allow communities to see their cultures flourish, for their religions, for all those things. That's no problem. We're not talking about abolishing people's cultures or identities. What we're talking about is equality. And I think all I'm saying is that we have to recognize that after 40 years of preaching the same doctrine of separation and ethnic states, recognize that this has failed and open our minds to alternatives. I agree that international law should be the basis, but there are more ways to implement it than ethnic separation in states which will become ever more extremist. So open your minds to it. I think it's possible. And the last thing I'll say is that a couple of years ago when I first started writing about this, people were saying it was crazy. I couldn't get a hearing. Now, the most mainstream idea is that the two-state solution is over. People are saying it's over. What they're not saying quite yet, or not in sufficient numbers, is okay, what's next? And that is the next step, and that debate and that discussion is about to hit big time.
Thank you, Dr. Hinkelstein and Chair Abu Naiman.